And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
I had a conversation with Aswin Gunasekar, founder and CEO of Zedu, a few weeks ago, and we discussed how antiquated EEG technology had been. With Zedu technology, patients now can receive faster and better EEG tests anywhere. And for those who don't know, EEG tests help rule out brain tumors and diagnose seizure disorders and sleep problems. I've known Aswin for a few years now. We met when he started Zedu, and it's been amazing to see his journey and achievement in bringing this technology to patients. It's so great to have him in the Rosenman ecosystem. Aswin started his career in management consulting and had electrical engineering background before he founded Zedu. Here's our conversation. Well, Aswin, thank you for joining me today. Finally, we've known each other for, gosh, a long time now. It feels like when we just started the Rosenman Institute and when we met, when you showed me about what you're working on. But I thought it would be good to start a little bit about your journey, how you chose this path and why this path. How do you get here?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, Christine. Appreciate it. I know you've been one of our ardent supporters and actually, you know, helping entrepreneurs such as me in the medtech community build, you know, their dreams up. So thank you for that and all the support that you've given with nothing asked in return, honestly. There's very few people such as you. So thank you. I'm happy to talk about my journey. I'm an electrical engineer by training, electrical/computer engineer. I went to grad school in University of Texas at Austin, and I worked in the field of microprocessor design, specifically at AMD, designing, you know, the latest and greatest silicon chips. To me, there was a lot of technical depth, and I learned a lot, but I was actually, you know, looking for fresh air because I was so much deep into that realm. And I went ahead, like most people do, look for an outlet. I went to business school at the University of Texas at Austin as well. And it literally, for me, the best part of the journey was I let it come to me. I wasn't chasing something for a career change in particular because I was happy at my job. So I was kind of like absorbing it at my own pace. And there was a class which was called New Venture Creation. And it was almost like the capstone of, you know, all the things that you learned over the last 2 years. And you apply that towards, you know, building a business. And it was rightfully named Capstone or a New Venture class. And I really loved what the professor taught me. His name was Rob Adams. It was about opportunity validation. And the one thing that I took from the class is, if you build it, they may not come. You want to first study the opportunity and really, really drill down on why you're building what you're building. And that really ignited a spark in me. And during that class, I formed a team and we started digging into, you know, what can we actually do which is meaningful for us. You know, I realized that to get up every day and do something and potentially for a very long journey, you really need to be in it and have, you know, a story to dig deep into. And my cousin, who has a severe form of epilepsy, his story came up. And voila, you know, I started learning more about it. And I realized, oh, they diagnose epilepsy with EEG, which is literally an electrical phenomenon of the brain. And I was like, wait, I'm an electrical engineer. I can actually make this thing much better as of today. But what happened? And then after that, it was just a whole bunch of driving around to doctors, meeting EEG technologists, meeting epilepsy patients and their families. And I moved to the Bay Area. I took up a job in management consulting. I was studying this opportunity in the background. And about a year and a half later, I quit my job Friday, and Monday I started the company. And about a few weeks later, I came to you. I said, I have no clue, Christine, like, what do I do now? And you said, we have this startup in a box program. So that was the first half of the
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, what, you know, oftentimes, as an entrepreneur, oftentimes you need to know how to juggle. And obviously, you've done that. You do a lot of your background thinking while you're employed, while you're trying to refine about a lot of your thinking behind it. But it's interesting with your background coming from the high tech company before to come to the healthcare. And I think when I met, I mentioned about, like, I did not know this problem has not been solved yet, because I did work on this EEG project many, many years ago and left. I thought that problem has been solved. But what it needs is somebody from the tech industry to tell us how to do it.
Right. I think I just looked at it as a complete outsider. And you have that, the power of naivete that drives you. You just realize, oh, wait, it's just something wrong about this. Well, actually, insiders don't actually ask the same questions. And that's what really drove me in the beginning. And I just didn't take no for an answer early on. And I always tell folks, if I had been in the industry, I would have known better not to do it, because that information would have clouded my judgment. That was the story. Because, you know, for the audience, what is EEG? It's literally EKG, but for the brain, and it's a continuous running time scan of how your neurons are firing. It indicates neuronal activity, and the biggest problem I saw was people, they get wires and all that stuff attached to their head, and they need a trained EEG operator to administer this test, which is an important test for several neurological conditions. So that's what came at me first.
Yeah, I think one thing that maybe you can touch on a little bit about the challenges that the current system have, so that our listeners can see, like, why we need an innovation in this space. If you can touch on that, that'd be great.
Yeah, we start with, what EEG, what insight it provides for a neurologist. Unlike an MRI or a CT, which is an image snapshot of your brain, EEG is a continuous running time scan, which, when did a seizure occur? Which lobe of the brain did it start from and how did it spread? For sleep disorders, what sleep cycle you are in, EEG is the gold standard for diagnosing that. And it has a tremendous amount of potential for other conditions like autism, for example. By looking at the entropy index of the networks forming, you can accurately predict whether an infant is predisposed to autism spectrum disorder or not. So with all this potential, what I saw was, a process that was stuck in archaic times. And if you look at the EEG value chain, how do doctors get to, finding the info that they need to find to treat the patient? You always have acquiring the signal and accessing the data, interpreting the info and diagnosing it. But I found that acquiring the data, accessing the info and accessing the data and interpreting the info were the three major steps at the front end were completely broken. And acquiring, we just spoke about it, needing a trained EEG operator, gluing the wires, putting the patient through a poor experience was limiting the availability of EEG in several hospitals. And accessing the data, again, all this data was sitting on hard drives of computers and, not being able to provide insight with, on this data and then interpreting the info. At the end of the day, the human brain can process, let's say, four dimension stops, a cube moving through space. But here we have over 20 electrodes across time. And computers are just better at, processing it and providing insight. So we at Zedo believe that it's not that software will become the new MD in terms of respect to reading EEG, but we just believe human beings or patients deserve machine intelligence to supplement a physician's interpretation. Why not, right? Mm-hmm. With the insight, when the insight of many can be applied to the betterment of an individual patient. Mm-hmm. So that's our outlook on the EEG value chain. And Zeto actually comes at it very holistically.
And I noticed that when you're looking at like potential of how to do a lot of data analysis on your data input, but also you're also doing some innovation on the how EEG is being measured or interpret like of the hardware.
Yes.
And how cumbersome it is right now compared to what your technology is.
Right. So I definitely can talk to you about that. But, you know, we at this point are really focused on the process improvement. We want to provide a 10x process improvement because it's one thing to talk about the future, but, you know, there's a cadence to that. You know, I think you first need to go after and remove all the grunt work, all the inefficient work that physicians, EEG technologists, and caregivers do so that they can be more productive in providing patient care. So in that regard, the first thing that when you see a product, which is a helmet, is literally a wearable helmet with sensors that are very comfortable. It can be fitted like a bike helmet with individually dialable bands. And they don't need to be prepped. Their skin doesn't need to be prepped. They don't need to be they don't need to use electrode paste and whatnot. And so on the signal acquisition side, it becomes a lot easier. And the helmet itself is able to do what a traditional EEG does very well in a much more simplistic fashion is because of the advanced noise cancellation, the advanced electrical engineering in the helmet. EEG is three orders of magnitude smaller than ECG. And as a result, it gets slammed by noise in the room, you know, just by, you know, your lines, noise, and all that. So we do several important real-time noise cancellation techniques, just like a Bose noise canceling headphone does. And that's the front end. So the comfort of the patient and the convenience for the user is front and center for what we do. We do that better than anybody else, I believe, in the industry today. And then on the back end is how the cloud collects the data. You can seamlessly view it remotely from anywhere and don't have to have a neurologist on call to read the EEG.
Yeah, that's great. And so you guys are in the market?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us more about how you get there. It's a long journey.
Yeah. I mean, specifically, would you like to know our early commercialization efforts? Or okay. Yeah, so we got FDA cleared in 2018, which was our first-gen device. And from then on, you take a first-gen, first-manufactured device to, you know, third-gen, third-manufacturing. That is what's commercializable, right? You know that very well. So since then, we've been working hard at that, making improvements, and all still within the realm of the same 510K application. And now here we are with our product being very useful for any outpatient EEG, which is any short EEG, which is reimbursable through about six CPT codes. It's just a process improvement, not an outcome change. So it's easier for us to go make a convincing statement for a sale. And in the hospitals, given the crisis with COVID, several hospitals are coming to us to monitor patients for subclinical seizures in the ICU and also what is called status epilepticus. And their draw right now is, hey, with a smaller footprint and easier to clean, it minimizes the exposure to their staff. And even, you know, there's no cleanup of the patient. You just remove the headset, wipe it down, and you're ready for the next patient. So in those regards, we have a compelling story to provide. And we are figuring out the sales motion part of it. So we believe that there's really good, strong product market fit. We have to still figure out the product market sales motion fit. This is still the first year of commercialization for us. Mm-hmm. And it's been a very exciting journey.
Yeah, I mean, what did you learn, like, you know, 3 years ago compared to like what you knew 3 years ago and what you know now, what are the things that you would have done differently?
Done differently. Very, very interesting question. I would have done a few things faster, I would say. You know, our funding took a little longer than expected. So I would have definitely pushed for getting more resources and, you know, expediting some of the early things that we did with respect to, hey, what tweaks do we need to make in the product? You know, how does it hold up for everyday use? Does it deliver on a day-to-day basis? And making those tweaks in the product. That's what I said by going from first-gen, first manufacturing to a third-gen, third manufacturing kind of stage. And then second would be, I think that's primarily it. What I would continue to do is be very, very particular about, you know, how we're building the company. I'm not sure. And again, this is because I'm a first-time CEO. I'm not sure, Christine, whether I should speed that up, but it served us really well on who we bring on as a part of the first team. We're still part of the, you know, when we bring on a commercial person, they're still very much part of the first team. And we hire for fit as much as we hire for skill. And so I would continue to do that. Maybe I'd speed that up a little bit. But I don't know how you can strike a balance.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, I think finding the right people is always so important.
Yeah, right.
Wasn't everybody right. Hire slow, but fire quickly.
Right. And, you know, sitting in Silicon Valley, you cannot not get pulled by the blitzscaling approaches that other tech companies do. But I'm not sure if it's relevant for us in medtech, especially to grow fast and for. I constantly ask why. It's not like I'm compromising. If I'm compromising on something, I'm going to take a very good hard look at it. But if I can grow carefully, building you know, my customer base with utmost care, because you know every customer calls up a reference, they're like, hey, I heard you're using the product. How is it holding up, right? And that's so important in the first year, first 1 or 2 years, until you hit that critical mass and the product can, you know, sustain itself. So for me, that is kind of important. I've kind of erred on the slow but steady side.
Yeah, I think in the med tech space, you definitely have to be steady. It's not about like just quickly put something in a market and learn from that mistake, because that's not how the industry works. And
I'm not sure if you can fail fast, especially when you have a patient sitting for that procedure.
I think that is very true in this industry, and I feel like people who are in this industry, they're passionate about, you know, improving the patient outcome. And so they're willing to put the hours and the hard work to it.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
I want to go back a little bit about, you know, because we kind of segued a little bit on your technology and your company, but you mentioned about this project started off from your capstone. And is this the same that you brought in from your Texas, or you built a new team when you started?
That's interesting, because I had 4 members on my team. And to be honest, none of them wanted to be part of the startup. They all had their own reasons, of course. Uh-huh. And you know how important it is to have a co-founder. And I was like, man, am I the only fool here? The guys who won the capstone competition in Texas, they themselves are not coming on board. So, but I didn't care. I was like, if I don't have a co-founder, I'm going to go at it and take the next step. So that's what happened. So it was literally me starting as a solo founder.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you even remember this conversation. We had one time hosted this congressman, Eric Swalwell, came.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, I know. You were there. And one of the things that I think he was there to talk about how can he help the startup community. And I think one of your questions you were saying about, you know, the visa issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an immigrant as well. We tend to be risk takers and we tend to be entrepreneurial. Tell us more about, like, do you think that drives you to be more entrepreneurial compared to your other teammates at school at that time?
To be honest, the reason was my wife had a steady job. That was one of the reasons.
You have hedged risk.
But that aside, it's actually my, how I grew up. My mother always used to push me for go do this, go do that. You know, why didn't you do this? Or, you know, why were you not number one in this? That kind of competitive spirit is always inside me. People who know me, they probably can attest to that. So that was really it. And I at that point, you know, I was about 33, 34 at that point, Christine. And I wanted to do something meaningful with my life, you know, because I didn't want to be a cog in the wheel, which I was, you know, a bigger part of things. And, you know, it's frustrating when you do great work for a big corporation and they either don't make money or it really is not moving the needle for you in a fulfillment sense. And so that coupled with a drive to, hey, I want to also prove myself. It's not rocket science. Let me go try it. And if I fail, I'll fail with dignity after all. And then my wife told me, hey, you have a couple of years runway. And I was like, hey, great. Okay. In 2 years, I can do amazing things. But you know how slow things are. I took my first salary after 5 years, Christine.
Well, I'm glad that you have a very supportive wife, and I'm glad that you did not stop after 2 years. And how do you convince her to keep at it after 2 years when she told you only have 2 years to get these things going?
Yeah, execution. I guess you know, some of the results were there, and she was also, and she's a very clear. She's an engineer at Apple. She would have clearly said, no, no go. You're not moving the needle here. But luckily for us, you know, the technology was building. You know, I literally put the product on her head and show her the brainwave. She was like, this guy's up to something. let me give him another year runway and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you've I've seen how the progress that you make along the way. It does seem slow when you're at it, when you look back. It's just like, you know, because there's so much going on. And one of the things that I want to ask you a little bit is, being an engineer, I learned that you do a lot of things more systematic. I think, you know, knowing how to manage your project, manage your time. And I think that is a skill that as an executive need to have. Do you have any tips on people to make sure that, you know, because there's two kind of CEO, like somebody with a vision and somebody who know how to execute. And that's two different skill. And I don't, you know, how do you manage your time and how do you manage your team and to keep at it?
That's a great question. I think you need both. I think you need to really, really visualize where your company needs to be 3-4 years downstream and really imbibe it, because that honestly, leadership is a transfer of emotion to your team as well, right? Like if they see it and you say, hey, we're not going to try, it's a done deal. Mm-hmm. They follow. And as for some reason, I'm very, very particular about that, because if I don't feel the conviction, I go back and work on the approach. So that's number one. And then second is the mechanics of it. So one part was actually the psychology piece. That is actually... that's actually 80%, honestly. 20% is mechanics. So on the mechanics part, I try to really set keep things simple. What is our next milestone? And we divvy it up into very clear deliverables. And being an engineer and product manager, I can actually combine both hardware and software and, you know, literally have, you know, weekly time roles. Even for hardware, you know, we are very clear about these tasks need to be executed and keeping that going. We always never, ever hit those plans. But getting deeper into, hey, why it's not working out, listening to our engineers and actually using your power as CEO to help them, either to add resources or to change the what we want as outcome is super important. So that has helped me with my background as an engineer. I'm not sure if that's the only way that it works. I'm sure a lot of CEOs bring their own skill set, but this has helped me in being very particular about execution and keeping the ball rolling.
Yeah, and so that's great, and I'm glad that you're willing to share that. A little bit about the fundraising, you know, as a CEO, I mean, mm-hmm. Fundraising is always on the back of your mind.
Yeah,
all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You recently erased your round. It's not recently, it's been a while, but tell us more about that process.
It was long. Each company has its own features of what people see about it. And we're in the neuro space, and EEG is not the most sexiest things of all. So for me, I did see those challenges earlier on. And you know, I was particular about pitching to a lot of people who saw what I'm trying to build and how far I've come and who were able to appreciate it, because now I was able to better kind of resonate these folks who I can bring on. Because for me, it was more important. It was less about valuation and stuff and more about having the right people who I can work with. And so for me, I was focused on that. It took a little longer during that process. But eventually, a good group of investors came along. Even one deal didn't go through, another investor took up the lead position and made it come through. So grateful for all of that, mm-hmm. Honestly. So that was my journey. And everything, especially fundraising, you know, 2x, 3x the time that you're planning, because you never know. And it's interesting. One of my board members was always saying, what do you know? What the stock market crashes, the pandemic might hit. And it really did hit. and you have to be prepared for the black swan events also, you know, just in case it happens. And it's always good to be capital efficient, honestly.
Right. I think it's, and I always think that everything always takes longer, right? Fundraising definitely. I mean, you always, you know, I never met anybody so far who said like, oh, that was 30 seconds. We'll get it done, right? On the first try.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fundraising. And it was a challenge for me because as a first-time entrepreneur, I had to show through my previous execution and through a lot of getting to know the investors that, hey, we can continue to build. I'm still the right person to lead, and you know, we have this beautiful vision. So yeah, still learning. Yeah.
Tell us the process. Is do you think like you meet the investor one and twice, and then they say, okay, let's go get to the deal, or is it something that you have to continuously build that relationship before they buy the first?
It was a long process because there's this dance of due diligence where they getting to know you. Of course, the first thing you do is get the lead investor on board. And then there are a host of other investors who are, you know, asking for who the lead investor is and trying to get onto the boat. So it's a little bit of a dance and a little bit of very transparent information sharing. It will be very frustrating, but be as transparent as you can, because it's important to bring on the right investor and have that right fit. Else it's going to be way more miserable than the fun of that momentary pleasure of raising the money and closing the round.
Yeah, because you do have to work with them quite a bit.
It's super critical, and they can help in many ways. So it's super important.
Yeah. So what do you guys do as a team now with this pandemic shelter in place? Are you back in the office? How do you manage that?
Yeah. Virtual conferences, a lot of our leads were coming through conferences. So that inbound part of the leads, we're doing it through virtual now. But now we are also doing outbound. We just increased our sales team. We tripled our sales team size. A lot of virtual selling as well. So we're adapting to that picking up. It's a new process, even for the most experienced medical device salespeople. And actually, they're so in tune to in-person selling that, you know, the CEO, I will need to coach, you know, good things about virtual selling, right? Yeah. And doing a lot of the work through a Zoom call. And with respect to engineering, operations, and supply chain, really back on to the usual normal working day for us.
I'm curious if you can tell us more about this virtual selling. Eventually down the road, you know, without COVID, I think company probably can see if you can do virtual selling very well, it's a good way to be capital efficient.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you see that you need to have?
Why are you sitting on a flight for, you know, 4 or 5 hours to meet this person when you could have done the early part of the sales process completely virtually? And especially with a product like ours, which is completely connected product, you know, literally they can log on and see what they need to see live. Yes, the human touch, feel, smell part of it is missing, but you can definitely do it for the close of the sale. And you can have a better sales funnel management with respect to virtual selling. And this, again, this is so new that ourselves are learning. We are also learning from outside sources who are flooding it with information. Mm-hmm. So I totally agree. I want to be capital efficient. And one of the biggest customer acquisition costs for us is the travel part for our sales force and getting those meetings. When you can do it simpler within a 20-minute Zoom call instead of getting an appointment and the doctor coming to a particular room and stuff, it reduces friction, mm-hmm. right? But that said, not every doctor knows how to download Zoom and get that stuff going. So yes and no, but for most part, I think it helps.
I think with the pandemic, the whole telehealth also. Accelerate the intake of doctors to be more tech savvy.
And it becomes an acceptable norm right now, right? And so nobody's questioning, why are you selling it to me virtually? Because, hey, else you're never going to see me for 6 months. They're more inviting that way. Like,
am I not important for you to travel this far? but what's the do's and don'ts in a virtual selling that you've done so far the last 6 months?
Actually, we're really figuring that out. We didn't actually, a lot of our customers were literally closed for 3 months. So now we're picking up that a part of the process. A lot of it goes back to, spending that first 5 minutes listening to what they have to say and challenging them through a virtual screen to a bigger, brighter future with our product, and then getting into, you know, their pain points. It's the same sales process, you know. This is the world that, you know, we see happening. These are the pain points, and here's our product that happens to be a solution for it. The same sales process, just the delivery mechanism mm-hmm. is changed, and we have to lend a coaching hand, you know. On these things. And it's a lot of trial and error, honestly. I try a few things. My head of sales tries a few things. And my talented salespeople come back with information. We put it together and we do what we need to do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much. You know, we're definitely adapting to the new world with the Zoom. And it's interesting. That makes life interesting every day, I guess.
So. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's been so fun to have you on our podcast, and it's been great to know you. And so honored to have you in our ecosystem and our founders program here.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you so much. It is my honor and privilege to be part of the UCSF Rosenmind community and to be helpful along the long run, I sincerely hope. And thanks for all the things you do from your side in continuing to help us and enrich our community. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Casper Mossman, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.